if I speak freely, can you hear me at the back? Yes, good. Super. Thank you very much, Richard. It's wonderful to have this opportunity, and I've learned a great deal from your work, and I'm looking forward to your book on this subject. What I'm going to do is to give you a kind of interim report on this project and my own work on free speech and on the book, and think aloud about some of the issues that have arisen. Let me start, as befits the age of Facebook, interactively, by asking you two questions. First of all, is there anyone in this lecture hall who does not think that free speech is, broadly speaking, a good thing? Please raise your hand if you take that view. I was one person, wonderfully, I must say that was a wonderful English hand gesture, did that at the back, like that. Occasionally a Chinese student raises his or her hand on this. Okay, now the second question is, does anyone in this room not have in your pocket, bag, or left at home something like that? A few more, two or three. A few, normally, shall I say, not the very youngest in the room raise their hand, sometimes defiantly. Well, in a way, the subject today is John Stuart Mill meets the smartphone. Because the subject is free speech, upon which many of the principles are very ancient indeed and have been explored for centuries by philosophers, by which, of course, we mean freedom of expression and freedom of information, in completely transformed circumstances. Because this thing in your pocket or bag, the internet more broadly, has completely transformed the conditions of free speech. It is, in effect, creating a world in which everyone is tendentially becoming neighbours with everybody else. There has never been a world in which, just by taking this magic box out of your pocket, you could, at least in theory, communicate directly with half of humankind, and the numbers going up very, very rapidly. This is obviously a huge chance for free speech, but it also brings many dangers in ways that were not there before. Threats of violence, fatwas, spoken in one country, in Tehran or Raqqa, can be carried out very rapidly in another. I have in the book a whole case study on the so-called Innocence of Muslims YouTube video, in response to which more than 50 people were killed in riots in countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan. Many of them had never seen the video. It brings, of course, extraordinary and dangerous possibilities for the erosion of privacy. As many of you will know, an American expert on the internet said, surveillance is the business model of the internet. They make their money, Facebook, Google, Twitter, Amazon, Apple, by knowing a huge amount about you and therefore selling you in customized fashion to advertisers. The possibilities, the amount of data that they have is beyond a Stasi general's wildest dream. If that is combined with what the state knows, as Edward Snowden showed in the American and British case, it becomes extremely worrying. Even more so in China, where China is actually developing a system, attempting to develop a system of so-called social credit ratings, where every Chinese citizen will have their social credit rating based upon not just their credit rating, but their loyalty to the party, their social behavior, their trustworthiness in the view of the authorities, a truly Orwellian potential. And then, of course, harassment, cyberbullying, hate speech, fake news, and all these other dangers that come at us. I say in the book that the internet is actually the biggest sewer in world history. All that shit just waiting to come out at you through the box in your pocket. So the question is, of the book, of the project, is how do we maximize the chances for free speech given us by these transformed circumstances and minimize the dangers? Now, this, as Richard mentioned in his introduction, I've been pursuing for about 10 years. Initially, I thought I was just going to write that old-fashioned Gutenberg object, a book, this thing here. But I was sitting writing about this subject in Stanford at my other university, which, of course, Facebook, Google, Twitter, all just up the road in Silicon Valley. And I thought to myself, if you're writing about the post-Gutenberg world, how can you just go on writing about it in the old-fashioned Gutenberg way? Why don't you use the possibilities of the post-Gutenberg world, i.e. the internet, to create a discussion, a dialogue, which would be part of the work on the book. So for my sins, and sometimes I've regretted I ever took on anything so mad, I, with colleagues here, created this research project, which is built around this 13-language website, which is actually, remarkably, an Oxford University website. I think rather bold of the university to accept that as under its wings, which in the 13 languages that you can see, if you can see clearly enough along the top, lays out both a set of principles for free speech in a connected world, but above all then has a mass of material, examples, stories, case studies, arguments for and against different positions, not just from Western scholars, journalists and contributors, but from scholars from many cultures. What we finally present on the website as the 10 draft principles here, in those 13 languages, and there they are, there's a map, there they are in just a few of the languages, is not what we started with. These principles, and perhaps it'd be kinder to give you them back in English, in case your Turkish is a little rusty. What we have here are a set of principles which have been refined, reordered, revised in the course of this multiple-year debate, in which I travelled to many of these countries for live debates, and then we had the debates online. I then produced the book last year. I've now been, for the last year, travelling around the world again, talking about these issues. The project is, and this is two points I want to emphasize, transcultural and interdisciplinary. Transcultural, not intercultural. That's a very important point. The clash of civilizations is a very bad idea, but the dialogue among civilizations is only slightly better. And the alliance among civilizations too, because both of them proceed from the utterly false premise that cultures are well-defined monolithic blocks, like the simple colours in a Mondrian picture, and that numerally self-appointed representatives can speak for Islam, or for Buddhism, or for Orthodoxy, or for Western civilization. This is, of course, profoundly untrue and dangerous. The picture of cultures is much more like a kokoschka, all the colours mixed up together with multiple shadings and stipplings. As Kwame Anthony Appiah said, cultural purity is an oxymoron. So transcultural means recognizing that there are differences across cultures, but that many of the most important differences, precisely when it's the subject of free speech, are actually within Islam, within Orthodox culture, within the West, between Europe and the United States. And we want to have the debate transculturally across these cultures. Interdisciplinary, something we pay lip service to in universities, but normally do by way of multi-author volumes and conferences, because people with good reason are quite reluctant to go beyond their own disciplines. And, you know, there are good reasons for that. I have madly set out on the high seas to draw upon, but you have to in studying this subject, disciplines which are not my own. So beside contemporary history and international relations, you have to look at computer science, sociology, anthropology, literature, evolutionary psychology, law, of course, philosophy, business studies. You have, I think, to give a coherent account of what is going on, to draw on all these disciplines. So that's what I've bravely or foolishly tried to do in this book and in this project. Now, let me proceed quickly to give you the bare bones of the argument and then focus in on a few of the principles. So the argument starts from the premise that in the connected world, in the world of neighbours that the internet has given us, the old rule of thumb about free speech no longer applies. That was, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. If you're in the United States, you have the First Amendment tradition. If you're in England, you have English common law. If you're in India, you have English custom and law, and so on and so forth. This no longer holds, applies, can be adhered to when there are people in Rome from everywhere as a result of mass migration, and what people say in Rome can almost instantaneously be heard everywhere. So the rule of thumb no longer applies. I argue that your effective freedom of speech, wherever you are, today is the result of an intersection of basically four forces. First of all, international organizations, treaties, networks. From formal treaties like the European Convention or the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights with its Article 19, some of them actually with multinational or transnational, supranational courts like the European Strasbourg Court trying to implement them, through much more informal bodies like ICANN, which although formally a not-for-profit corporation incorporated in Southern California, actually is a body responsible for apportioning IP names and numbers, which is the absolute backbone, the spine of the internet, to the Internet Engineering Task Force, which is a totally informal body. And then three other kinds of force. I call them the big dogs, the big cats, and the mice. The big dogs are the governments, the big cats are what I call the private superpowers, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, Apple, and the mice are you and me. Now, in the heady early days of the internet, which is, of course, not just as American as motherhood and apple pie, but more American than motherhood and apple pie, there was this cyber-utopian fantasy that states would become irrelevant in the face of the liberating power of the internet. And the classic statement of this, written by the lyricist of the Grateful Dead, John Perry Barlow, is something called the Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, which he wrote in 1996. I quote, "Governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You have no sovereignty where we gather." Magnificent stuff, and of course, completely wrong. Completely wrong, and it's proven so. The more demotic version of this view was given by Bill Clinton in the year 2000, when he was still American president, when he said, for China to try to control the internet would be like trying to nail jello to the wall. And the Chinese Communist Party turned around and said, Bill, just watch us. And actually, if you look at what's happened in China over the last, well, since that time, the Chinese Communist Party has made a pretty good stab at nailing jello to the wall. And the other day I was in Beijing and I actually drove past and I spied through the smog a great building with a wonderful title, the Cyberspace Administration of China. So much for John Perry Barlow. China has succeeded in doing this, asserting sovereignty over the internet, but only by building up what a Harvard University study argues, I think persuasively, is the largest apparatus of human censorship in history. And that's not just because China is a big country, it's also because since the internet has multiplied 10,000-fold the sheer amount of speech that there is, and there's a lot of it in China, you need a very large apparatus to control it. But as important for most of us who don't live in countries like China in determining our effective freedom of speech are the private superpowers, what the French call les GAFA. Because what they are, if Facebook was a country, it would be the largest country on earth. It has 1.9 billion regular monthly users. And in effect, what it is a privately owned global public sphere. And just to give you a sense of its dominance, there is the world map of social networks in 2009. You can still see many different colors. The colors indicate the leading social network in each country. Many different colors, still quite a heterogeneous picture. If we move forward to 2014, there we are. Facebook is the empire on which the sun never sets. The map of the world is painted blue. The only exceptions are really China, Russia, and one or two handouts, I think it's Kazakhstan there. That is an extraordinary power. And Facebook and Google and Twitter are making every day decisions about what you can or cannot see, which are non-transparent, non-accountable, and non-appealable. And I think that's a very important point. And then, of course, there's us, the mice. What are we to do against these giant powers? Well, I argue in the book that actually networked mice can have a very significant impact, and I give some examples of that, although I do think it's a problem that whereas you have great concentrations of power in the big dogs and the big cats, the states and the platforms, NGOs are actually on the whole very fragmented. And that has some advantage in terms of sort of creativity and energy, but also I think some significant disadvantage because you have multiple small free speech NGOs trying to influence these giant powers. Now, from the premise that your effective freedom of speech is a product of the interaction of these four factors, and that we live in this connected world, there follows the argument that we need to start at the level of norms, of first principles, rather than at the level of the laws, or indeed the, as it were, jurisprudential traditions, and indeed philosophical traditions, of particular jurisprudence, of jurisdictions. Because only when you work out the first principle, what is it you really want to achieve, that you then have to ask the question, how am I going to achieve that? And it may well be that in many areas, the most important addressee is not a government, is not the state. It may be Facebook, or it may be Google, or it may be an international body or network when it comes to the architecture of the internet. Hence, back to first principles. Now, back to first principles for those reasons, because we're living in a connected world. What I'm trying to explore in these principles is also the answers not just to one question, but to two fundamental questions. The first question is the one you'll all be familiar with. How free should speech be? That's a question of the philosopher and of the lawyer, above all. But the second question, which in my view is equally important, is how should free speech be? So that is to say, in the very large areas which a liberal believes the state should allow us to speak at our discretion, how should we choose to speak? How should we regulate our own speech with what I call robust civility? And interestingly, this is something on which the Western tradition of thinking about free speech has actually somewhat less to say than some other cultural traditions. So here, our colleague at Oxford, Leslie Green, is working on a book about the Buddhist tradition of right speech and trying to translate, as it were, into the terms of Western philosophy and legal discourse. As I say, trying to draw on the thoughts of other traditions, but also stripped down to essentials, precisely if you want to be transcultural, if you want to be global. The other day, I was visiting the place where Gandhi was assassinated in New Delhi. If you've not been there, it's a very, very moving place. And on the wall of his bedroom, they have one of his sayings, which is this: simplicity is the essence of universality. it's itself a very simple statement, but I think a very profound one. That's to say, if you are going to actually have a deep transcultural conversation, you have to strip things down to the essentials, to first principles, and strip away, so to speak, all the cultural integument which can get in the way simply of understanding. And so the effort here is to reach towards what I call a more universal universalism. And trying to do the simple exercise of translating the draft principles into 12 other world languages is extremely interesting, because it actually reveals where these deep cultural differences are. So, for example, our principle on religion is we respect the believer, but not necessarily the content of the belief. I'll come back to that as a thought. When you try to translate that into Arabic or Farsi or Urdu or even Turkish, you come up against a very revealing difficulty, which is there isn't an absolutely familiar generic word for the believer in any faith or ideology. What there is, there's a verb, a word, a noun for the believer in Islam, the one true faith, mu'min, some version of that word, or some very slightly sort of academic term for generic believer, but which sounds like something out of political science. It's not a familiar everyday term. By the way, this would have been true in Europe, of course, until actually into the 19th century. There would have been the believers and the infidels. That exposes, at the very level of language, a difficulty of having the conversation, a difficulty establishing this liberal principle about respecting the believer, but not necessarily the content of the belief. Now, I'm not going to run through all the classic Western liberal arguments for free speech. This is a very sophisticated audience. You will know them all. But I do just want to say a word or two about reaching for the arguments for free speech or about free speech, addressing my two fundamental questions: how free should speech be, how should free speech be in other cultures. And I think there are two reasons for highlighting and exploring and spending a lot of time looking at these arguments. One is substantive, because actually, surprisingly enough, surprise, surprise, other great civilizations have been thinking about these subjects often for longer than we have, and they have interesting things to say about them. And to give just one example, which Richard Sarabji knows better than I do, the Indian tradition of thinking about free speech, it seems to me, puts a particular emphasis on the qualities of the listener as well as the speaker. So, of course, in the Western liberal tradition, free speech is about the rights of the listener as well as the speaker, to speak or not to speak, to hear or not to hear. But in the Indian tradition, it says much more about the qualities of the listener. So if you look at the edicts of the King Emperor Ashoka, they have an idea of the perfect listener. I fear there'll be a Sanskrit speaker in the room who would apologize for my pronunciation. Bahusruta, I think, is a Sanskrit term, the perfect listener. That is the ideal. It's not just the speaker, it's the listener. And this goes all the way through to Mahatma Gandhi, who, in a speech to which I think Richard drew my attention in 1931, talked about the kind of speech that opens ears, doesn't close them. I think that's a wonderful image, opening ears. So substantively, there's a great deal to learn from other cultures, and I think we need to do a lot more of that, particularly in a world where non-Western powers are becoming richer, more powerful, increasingly setting the agenda. But there's also a, so to speak, strategic or even tactical argument, which has to do with the reception of ideas. So, in the 1890s, someone called, a Chinese scholar called Yan Fu, distinguished Chinese scholar, translated John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. And when you look at his translation, it's a very odd translation, because he doesn't really get what Mill is on about at all. The essence of Yan Fu's argument can be summarized as this. The West is rich and powerful. The West has free speech. We want China to be rich and powerful. Therefore, we must have free speech. It's an essentially instrumental argument. And the truth is that for much of the, until the late 20th century, there was something of that quality. That's to say, the fact that a particular idea came from the West was a huge bonus, all the way from Yan Fu to the Tiananmen Square generation with the Goddess of Liberty. Karl Marx, you will recall, famously said that the Herrschende Idee and the ruling ideas are always the ideas of the rulers. Well, I don't want to be such a crude materialist, but there is a rather uncomfortable for intellectuals connection between the power of ideas and the ideas of a culture's power, right? Now, it's almost the other way down. If you're trying to make this argument in the wider Middle East, or in India, or in Turkey, or in China, the fact that it is seen as a Western idea is almost a disadvantage rather than advantage. So at least strategically, it helps to discover those elements of these ideas which are present in other cultures. And I've made the experience in talking about these things that if you're able to refer to the cultures, the traditions of the country which you are in, even, you know, superficially, it opens up the conversation in a wonderful way. And it's also more difficult for rulers in these countries to claim cultural legitimation for suppressing free speech. So I give a wonderful example in the book. In 2013, the leading article of a rather liberal Chinese paper called The Southern Weekly was brutally censored and rewritten to extinguish the liberal and constitutionalist ideas. And there were many, many protests, often from a sort of Western liberal point of view, but one of the most effective came from a group of Neo-Confucians who made the argument entirely in Confucian terms, not a Western liberal argument in there. And that, I'm told, was much more unsettling to the authorities than anything that quoted John Stuart Mill or Ronald Dworkin. Now, so that's, as it were, that's the framework in which I'm working. Now let me come to the 10 principles, having clarified that they're stripped down to essentials, they're meant to be simple, they make the gamble of simplicity, so very dangerous thing to do with a sophisticated academic audience who can tear them all apart. In the book, there are chapters of 30 to 40 pages which explore these in great detail, explain the exact wording, why those wordings were favored over alternative wordings, test them against difficult cases from many places, not just from the West, and also ask the important question, who should do what? Who should do what to implement this principle? And by no means always is it the government, the state, who should do that thing. The first question to ask of this audience is, when you look at those 10, describing broad areas, is there a large area of major importance for free speech that you think is missing? I ask this question of our collaborators around the world. Most of them in the end, after the revision, said, no, you've got most of them there. Some might say that issues relating to gender and sexuality is such an important area that it deserves its own principle. I'm not quite sure what that principle would be. That's covered under the principle on diversity. But if you see a great area that's not covered, please speak in the discussion period, because I'd love to hear about it. Now, self-evidently, the intention is not the hubristic, megalomaniac notion that all these principles will be accepted by all, let alone accepted as binding by all. As Isaiah Berlin argued, that would be almost a parody of the monistic version of the Enlightenment, which Isaiah, speaking of Isaiah and Wilson College, of course, saw as actually having laid the seeds for totalitarianism. So it is absolutely not the sort of IKEA monistic version of the Enlightenment. There's the kit, go to IKEA, and if you can understand the instructions, you can assemble your perfect liberal public sphere. Rather, it is precisely the enterprise which Isaiah was involved in for much of his career, which is the attempt to marry two quite distinct things, liberalism and pluralism. Liberalism and pluralism, and the pluralism in question being both the political and cultural and philosophical pluralism of which I've been talking. So the question then becomes, what are the essential minimum conditions on which you would not be prepared to compromise, and what are the others on which there might be reasonable compromise across cultures and countries? And actually, what we did was to reorder the principle so that the first two have, as it were, a distinct and higher status. So principle number one is, as you will immediately see, a kind of simplified statement of the famous Article 19, the legally binding form of which is in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and to which most countries in the world have actually signed up. So even in a country like China or Russia or Iran, your government has signed up to it. Our version says, we, all human beings, must be free and able to express ourselves and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas, regardless of frontiers. By the way, regardless of frontiers, an absolutely visionary statement when it was first made in the late 1940s in the UN Declaration on Human Rights. Now, of course, because of the internet, a reality. We have done one thing there. We've added the words and able, because we don't think that the beggar is free to dine at the Ritz, and we don't think an illiterate Indian peasant who has no internet access and virtually no education effectively enjoys a right to free speech. So informed by the capabilities approach of Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum and others, we've added the words and able. So someone, and there's a map of illiteracy which is on the site. You can see the darker, the higher proportion of illiterate, so you can see much of Africa is well up at the 50% plus level. Meaningless to say, most people in those countries enjoy effective freedom of speech. And similarly, internet access. Here we have, No, we don't. We've lost him. We have Tim Berners-Lee on the site anyway. Now, the second principle, which, as I say, came shooting up to this top salience, is we neither make threats of violence nor accept violent intimidation. And what is, as it were, to be remarked on that is not so much the first part, because every liberal jurisdiction in the world that I know of bans direct incitement to violence, but putting up equally the second part, nor accept violent intimidation. The two being equally important, two sides of the same coin. Because my conclusion is that actually the acceptance of violent intimidation, yielding to violent intimidation, resulting in self-censorship out of fear, is one of the major threats to free speech in our time. Also in Britain, in Europe, in the West more broadly. We have what I call, by analogy with the famous heckler's veto, the assassin's veto. Let me see if I can get this up. Okay, we haven't got it, we've lost it. The assassin's veto. That is to say, people who say, if you say that or publish that, we will kill you. And that threat is sufficiently credible, viz. The murders of the Charlie Hebdo journalists, for people to self-censor out of fear in response. One of our Indian contributors wrote a very interesting piece which extended this idea to the matter of dress in India, and she talked about the rapist's veto. Now, if you accept the absolute salience of this principle with its two sides, neither threatening violence nor accepting violent intimidation, then you say that all the powers at our disposal, including those of the state, the courts, the police, with its the state with its monopoly of legitimate violence, should be called upon to enforce this principle, unlike some of the others. And then the question becomes, so how do you distinguish those areas of speech? Now, this American scholar, Susan Benesch, I think pioneered what I think is a very powerful distinction, I hope we can talk about it in the discussion period, which is that between hate speech, which is, as you will know, a very broad category covering a multitude of things, and what she defines as dangerous speech. That is to say, that speech, that expression, which is intended and likely to cause violence. Again, in discussion, we can refine the question of intended, likely, and imminent, which is, of course, the Brandenburg test in the First Amendment tradition. What is imminent on the internet, where everything is immanent? But I think the basic distinction between hate speech, this broad category of hate speech, and the narrower category of dangerous speech is one that is extremely valuable and needs to be pursued. Now, I want to leave plenty of time for discussion, so that I'm going to abridge slightly my remarks. I was going to go into greater depth on a couple of other principles, but my sense is that it might be better to leave that to the discussion period. So let me just point you to them and signal this, and then leave it for discussion and conclude. I think two which have been particularly interesting in the debates that have arisen over the last couple of years are the one on journalism, where the issue has become whether we are losing what I call the uncensored, diverse, and trustworthy media we need for democratic self-government, for reasons that I'd be happy to spell out in the discussion period. The interesting point here is most of the things that have gone wrong and most of the things that might be done about it have very little to do with the state. The issue of regulation or of state intervention is really only at the margin of this issue about the transformation of the media landscape, the possibilities it gives for fake news, alternative facts, and so on. The other one, which I hope we can talk about a bit more in discussion, is the one on religion. I laid this out in an earlier version to a group of Indian MPs from all parties. They said their reaction was very interesting. They basically said, well, most of this we're quite happy with in the Indian context, even the diversity one, but that one on religion, you can't do that in India. And literally, Sikh, Muslim, Hindu, secular, they were all jumping up and down, and I mean literally jumping up and down, complaining about it. But when I then said why, this became more interesting, because essentially two different lines of argument opened up. One line of argument was, These things are inseparable. Respect me, respect my faith. Disrespect my faith, you disrespect me. It's simply intrinsic. There's nothing you can do about it. This is simply unacceptable in principle. The other line of argument was, well, we see what you're arguing for. We understand why in principle that would be desirable in a multicultural society, so that we don't end up not being able to talk about all the taboos of all the faiths and belief systems in the world. But you can't do that yet in India, because there'd be riots and people would be burning down each other's shops, because that's what's happened in India. As you can see, these two different ways of reading the critique open up completely different lines of conversation. The first, there's really nowhere further you can go. You just in the end may have to say, okay, you do it your way there, we'll do it our way here. But let's talk about the speech that is flowing across frontiers. The latter position opens up a whole conversation about what might be done with time to move towards a more liberal version of multiculturalism in India. In conclusion, let me just say a few words about where I think we've got to and some areas of, I think, would be fruitful discussion and research. So first observation, having, as it were, traveled to a number of countries really twice to present this project, once in about 2011, 2012, once last year and this, I have to tell you that in every single case, be it China, Russia, India, Turkey, Egypt, Hungary, Poland, the United States or Britain, free speech is more under attack now than it was 5 years ago. Free speech has gone backwards over those 5 years. I hope there's no correlation between my advocacy of it and it going backwards. I think that would, I hope, be the cause-correlation fallacy. What I think it is more is what I would call a global anti-liberal counter-revolution. I think it is really important to observe that this is not just illiberalism coming back, it's actually anti-liberalism. That is to say, a pushback against a really major advance of liberty and of the ideas of liberalism across the world over the last 20 to 30 years. Why am I therefore not in despair? Because even in these countries where free speech has been so much pushed back, as in China, as in Russia, as in Turkey, as dramatically in Egypt, there are whole generations and very large groups in these societies who do in large measure embrace the value of free speech, who have seized the opportunities given by the internet and don't want to give them up. And actually, you know, if I think any of this is worth continuing to do, it's because of those people who I meet both physically and virtually in these societies, who are enormously grateful for this as a resource, for this framework for thinking about what ideally you would want, even if at the end of the day you don't accept the whole framework. Next month I will be presenting it to the annual congress of an organization called IFEX, which is a network, a global network of free speech organizations, and talking with them about how to operationalize these ideas, how to make them actually more useful to people in these countries, also in the area of education. Because I think there's a lot to be done in actually boiling these ideas down to much simpler propositions and simpler stories for digital and media literacy, which is something we badly need. And I think we at Oxford maybe can do something about that. I also think it's important to note that I mentioned Britain among the list of countries where free speech has gone backwards, because we have our work cut out here at home. If you look at what was being proposed by the Prevent duty on universities, for example, if you look at successive rounds of counter-terrorism legislation, if you look at what the government is proposing to impose as duties on the platforms, I think we have quite a bit of work to do here. What finally could we do more of in Oxford? We've actually, as Richard knows, just got together a group of people working on these subjects from very different disciplines across the university, Oxford Internet Institute, Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, Law, Philosophy, Cultural Studies, and so on. It's amazing what's going on here and how little we know about each other's work. I think there are at least three areas where it would be interesting to take forward this sort of interdisciplinary conversation. The first is the one I started with, which is digging much deeper into this subject of thought about free speech in different cultures. I know you're doing that, Richard, in India, but I think those of us in this university looking at China, looking at the Islamic world, there'd be a lot of very interesting work to be done in bringing to the surface those ideas which are in these cultures, even if they are, for the most part, minority ideas. Secondly, I think a hugely important subject is to try and map what I call the public responsibilities of private superpowers. Because clearly the private superpowers now have a whole range, not just of powers, but in some important sense of public responsibilities in relation to privacy, in relation to counter-terrorism, in relation to hate speech, in relation to political speech, since they, for example, Facebook news feed is one of the major sources of news, and actually, if Facebook wanted to and tweaked their algorithm, they might even be able to throw an election. And I think we have to start by mapping the public responsibilities of the private superpowers, which they themselves are beginning to accept, and then get into a conversation with them about what they might do about it. And the third and final area, building on the distinction between hate speech and dangerous speech, is I think we need to do much more research. I have a little of it in the book, but much more research on what is effective counter-speech. That's to say, if you believe, as I do, that it shouldn't mainly be the job of the state to counter hate speech, it should be the job of the state to counter dangerous speech, but not hate speech, hateful speech, that as a good liberal we believe the answer to bad speech is more speech and better speech, counter-speech, the question then is an empirical one. What is effective counter-speech in the conditions of a connected world? For example, how do you get into the echo chambers of the populists, of the Trump supporters, of the Le Pen supporters? How do you get into these echo chambers where people believe that Britain was sending £350 million a year to Brussels, or that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, or the Jews were responsible for 9/11. So there's a whole, I think, set of very interesting research to be done on this subject of effective counter-speech. Those are three areas. I'm afraid I've thrown a lot at you in a rather short space of time, but I wanted to kind of lay out the picture. And please do come, even if you don't buy the book, which is, of course, available on all good Amazons. Please do come on the website. There's a mass of content on there, very interesting stuff. It's quite easy to search for it. Please place some comments. If you're in Oxford and you're a student and would like to work with us on the team for free speech debate, do please let me know afterwards. But meanwhile, I look forward to your comments and questions. Please speak freely. Thank you very much.